This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website at progressive.org. Today, we're going to be talking about the AIDS pandemic, and with me to talk about this is Stephen Lewis, who was the UN Secretary General's Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS in Africa from June 2001 to the end of 2006. Prior to that, he was Canada's ambassador to the United Nations. Stephen Lewis is the author of the prize-winning book, Race Against Time, Searching for Hope in AIDS-Ravaged Africa. It's out now with a new afterword. Stephen Lewis, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you, Matt.
How'd you become UN Special Envoy on AIDS in Africa? Is that something you apply for?
No, you don't apply for it, and it happened in an entirely unexpected way. I was simply asked by the Secretary General, whom I'd known for about 20 years because of having served as Canada's ambassador to the UN. And although I had done some work in the field of AIDS, particularly in relation to UNICEF and children, it was an unexpected phone call to suggest that I take on the envoy role in Africa, partly because there were no such envoys. This was an experiment, and partly because it felt a little beyond me, but I did it with all energy and good faith.
You mentioned UNICEF. You'd been deputy executive director at UNICEF.
Yeah, and it became obvious between 1995 and 1999, when I was the deputy, that everything we tried to do in Africa was sabotaged by the virus, that every time we tried to reduce infant mortality or maternal mortality, we'd turn around and things were going backwards for children because of the assault of the pandemic. And as a consequence, I felt more and more preoccupied with doing something. When I left UNICEF at the end of 99, I wanted to plunge into a role that was more useful around fighting AIDS, and along came the envoy prospect.
How did the AIDS epidemic or pandemic first make an impression on you?
I guess it made an impression on me statistically in the late 90s, when the life expectancy in many countries of Southern Africa, and where the infant mortality rates were rising, the life expectancy was dropping, I suddenly understood but didn't fully grasp the impact in terms of death and disintegration of societies. It was when I had left UNICEF, understanding that there was a terrible cataclysm occurring or about to occur, and visited Africa, that I felt it most profoundly. And I felt it most profoundly visiting the pediatric wards of the hospitals.
Well, do you want to describe one of those visits, one of those wards?
Well, I remember being in the university teaching hospital in Lusaka in Zambia. I guess it was in 2002 or 2003. And I remember vividly five and six children in a cot, beset by a combination of malnutrition and full-blown AIDS, these little morsels of kids. They were so desperate, so frantic, so emaciated. They were specters. And as I went through the ward with the lovely superintendent of the hospital, a really lovely man, I suddenly heard these anguished cries and screams which punctuated the visit every few minutes. I mean, it was Kafkaesque, and I'd turn around, compulsively turn around, and there, lo and behold, was a mother on her knees beside one of the cots, weeping inconsolably. The nurse comes in, covers up the infant with a sheet. I'll never get the image out of my mind of these mothers in succession, weeping, crying, overwhelmed with grief. And it was so matter-of-fact because it happened with such frequency.
Hmm. You're listening to Stephen Lewis, who was for the last 5 years the UN Secretary General's Special Envoy for HIV and AIDS in Africa. He's written a book, Race Against Time. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine. How is it possible not only for those mothers to contend with this tragedy, but for the director of the hospital, who you said was a lovely person, and for the nurse or the nurses on the ward to keep doing their work?
It is a question that's almost unanswerable. I don't know where they draw on the human capacity to keep going. I don't know what this reserve of resilience is in Africa. That's a continent of tremendous sophistication and intelligence and generosity of spirit at the grassroots in particular. That's evident as soon as you spend any time in Africa. And I've been going back and forth for 47 years. But you have to have a degree of commitment, a degree of immersion in the fight against the pandemic that keeps you going. There's no other way, because for so many years, there's a slight leveling off now, but for so many years, you were confronted with death so pervasive that it was personally annihilating.
And you can't get annihilated by it. And on the flip side, you can't get callous to it either. That must be a very difficult line to walk.
Nobody gets callous. The assumption, you know, that Africa is a lost continent or that people die with such regularity, what the hell, they're just used to it. This is so typically Western in its values.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that, because you tell the really horribly immoral anecdote in this book, Race Against Time, about the World Bank official who told you, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, that you're just going to have to let the people who have AIDS die, and it's a trade-off, use whatever money you have for prevention.
Yeah, it was as though a few million people, their lives are expendable, we'll get a better return on our investment if we put it in prevention, which, by the way, is not necessarily true at all. But the simple proposition that it would even lie in the mind, in some demented, twisted mind, that you let all of these people die. I mean, what is it about Africa? You know, I remember thinking about Rwanda and 800,000 people slaughtered in 100 days and the world raised not a finger, and now Darfur. There's some subterranean racism at work which is so unlovely it's hard to put a name to it.
Very ugly, actually. Tell me about the role of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. You throw a spotlight on that role in one of your early chapters in Race Against Time, Stephen Lewis. And it's not everybody who writes about the AIDS epidemic who talks about the World Bank and the IMF.
Well, the World Bank in the 1980s and 1990s had these structural adjustment programs, which were rigid economic programs which might be applied to a Western country but should never be applied to Africa, because they imposed conditions on the social sectors. They dismantled the health sector, dismantled the education sector, water, nutrition, sanitation. They did tremendous damage in economic terms. The bank had a practice of structural adjustment programs, as they called it, based on conditionality. We'll give you the loan if you fulfill these conditions. And the conditions were always punitive, always destructive of the basic fabric of the country. So the World Bank has a lot to atone for. Kids who can't pay school fees now and go to school, kids who are orphaned by AIDS, have to pay school fees because the World Bank insisted on fees being added to the educational system. The International Monetary Fund, to this day, I think, is completely out to lunch. They still embrace illusory, what they call macroeconomic frameworks. So if the Minister of Health in Kenya wants to hire some of the 4,000 retired nurses in Kenya to help repair the health system, she can't do that because the IMF says you'll breach our precious macroeconomic framework. We won't give you permission. What right have international financial institutions sitting in avarice in Washington to impose their policies on developing countries? I can't stand it.
Capitalist Stalinism, I think you called it in the book.
Well, I got occasionally carried away with my own rhetorical frenzy. But Matt, the bank at least, I have to acknowledge that under Wolfensohn, I'm not so sure about the present incumbent, but under Wolfensohn, the bank did begin to address questions of poverty. The question really is, are the new strategies qualitatively different from the old, or is it simply in wolf's clothing? And I'm not sure yet.
You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm speaking with Stephen Lewis, former ambassador of Canada to the United Nations and the UN Secretary General's Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS in Africa from 2001 to 2006. His book on the subject of AIDS in Africa, Race Against Time, I highly recommend it. Tell me what needs to be done to slow the ravaging of the AIDS epidemic in Africa.
we have to continue to roll out treatment and keep people alive. And treatment gives tremendous hope to communities. So when people know that they're testing positive, if they go out and get tested, and they can then have treatment to keep them alive, they will get tested. So countries know their status. When you know their, you know the status, it tends to reduce stigma and discrimination. We've also got to put a tremendous effort into the so-called preventive technologies in discovering a vaccine, discovering a microbicide. And it looks now as though male circumcision will significantly reduce the transmission for the men. We don't know yet the consequence for women, but the studies show that circumcised men have a reduction in transmission, Matt, of up to 60 or 70%. It's phenomenal.
And so what kind of resistance culturally is there to that?
Well, we don't know because we're just beginning to open up the possibilities of doing circumcision in medically secure and surgically secure environments. It looks as though there's going to be a tremendous demand. They're lining up from Swaziland to Zambia because they understand that although it isn't a cure and it isn't full protection, it is at least partial protection. The place where we have to make the greatest effort and is the most appallingly intractable area is gender inequality. The vulnerability of women, the grotesque proportion of women who are infected way above the numbers of men in percentage terms, and the inability to do anything about personal sexuality, control over personal sexuality, to say to the man, wear a condom or I'm negotiating safe sex. The women who do all the work in the society and all the caring in the society, the young women who marry older men and think they're in a monogamous relationship and the man brings the virus into the relationship. What people don't fully understand is that the virus is driven by predatory male sexual behavior, and it will take forever almost to change male sexual behavior, although we must try.
Do you want to explain that a little further? What specifically this is it? Are you talking about rapes or are you talking about?
Well, there's a great deal of sexual violence. As we know, rape has become a weapon of war. So in conflict, rape is pervasive. Let's look at Darfur. But sexual violence generally in many of these societies, partly because they're under siege, is widely played. It's terrible, the degree of rape and sexual violence. And there is a tremendous amount of marital rape in many of these countries, which is not even acknowledged because men will say in marriage, all sex is consensual. You can't have marital rape. So there is in the aspect of gender inequality, the sense that men have of absolute entitlement around matter sexual, it spreads the virus. And because you have truck drivers and traders and migrant laborers in the mines of South Africa and Botswana dealing inevitably because they're young men away from their partners for months, they're sexually active, they deal with commercial sex workers, they get infected, they take the virus back to the family. It's a sad constellation of transmission, and prevention can break it, but empowering women can help to break it.
I'm talking with Stephen Lewis, the author of Race Against Time, Searching for Hope in AIDS-Ravaged Africa. Also, is there the possibility, well, there are two things. There could be there's talk of a female condom, and there's also, then you need to get to the empowerment of women culturally and politically.
Yes, the female condom should be available in much greater numbers than it is. Partly because it's been so expensive, it hasn't been provided as widely. Even now, it's nowhere near the numbers of the male condoms, nor anywhere near the price. Empowering women, you know, you can pass laws against sexual violence. You can pass laws on inheritance rights and property rights and political representation and microcredit and economic empowerment. You can really do things to empower women. And if we were to be able to discover a microbicide, which is a foam or a gel or a cream vaginally applied, which can prevent transmission, then you give women some control over their own sexual autonomy. So the focus inevitably has to be on the women. It doesn't mean you don't do prevention with men. You do. But the women are dying now, and we don't have time to educate all the men because behavior change is going to take a couple of generations.
And one way to empower women is to educate women just through the schools. And Absolutely. That's been a big pitch of yours. Do you want to explain why that's so important?
Well, because in Africa, as in so many developing countries beyond Africa, it's the young boys who are favored, and they tend to go into school in the greater numbers. But even if the young girls go to school, they're the members of the family who are withdrawn from school when somebody falls ill. So if the mother falls ill of AIDS or the father falls ill, it's the young girl who comes out of school to look after them. It's the young girl who suffers then the potential of sexual violence. Girls are, as women, just very, very much more vulnerable in society as a whole. Look, between the ages of 15 and 24, there are several million people living with the virus. 78% of them are young women and girls. It is startling.
And why is the percentage so much higher among
partly because the girls are physiologically, anatomically more vulnerable. The vagina is much more vulnerable to scrapes and wounds and tears for the transmission of the virus, partly because the gender inequality makes the young women so disproportionately vulnerable.
There's a statistic in this book, Race Against Time, that jumped out at me. Many of them did, actually. But if you get a secondary education in Africa, you have a 2% infection rate. If you have a primary education level, you have a 6% infection rate. And if you have no education, you have something like a 12% education infection rate.
I think most of the world now agrees that education for girls is the way out of poverty. Education for girls to become mothers who understand issues of health and nutrition and food, etc. It makes all the difference in the world in the quality of life in the family and amongst the children. So education for girls and women is the centerpiece of a civilized emancipation for a society. And we've been struggling with that for a very long time. And in Africa now, you still have millions of kids who are not in primary school at all because they can't afford to get there.
And it is amazing. You write in the book about why there are price tags attached to even early education. Let's switch gears here a second, Stephen Lewis. Talk about how come the AIDS cocktails are so available in the United States, not available in Africa?
Well, they are becoming available in Africa, to be fair. They were always available in the United States because in the United States you could somehow afford them. People were able to gather personally the resources to pay, or there were some marginal health plans that could pay. In Africa, there were never any resources and never any health plans, and the cost of the antiretroviral drugs, as they're called, was way beyond the capacity of people living on less than a dollar a day. These drugs, until a few years ago, were costing $10,000 to $12,000 per person per year, thanks to the Clinton Foundation. God bless that foundation. They've done such astonishingly good work. They went off to India and they negotiated with the generic drug companies the exact equivalent generic compounds, and they are providing them now in Africa for roughly $139 per person per year. I mean, it's just astounding. And as a result, the drugs are being rolled out, although there is great worry about whether or not there will be the money to sustain the treatment over the long run.
Stephen Lewis is the author of Race Against Time, Searching for Hope in AIDS-Ravaged Africa. He was the UN Secretary General, Kofi Annan, Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS in Africa from 2001 to 2006. How would you assess U.S. policy, George Bush's AIDS policy?
Well, it's so interesting because who would ever have believed that George Bush in his 2003, I guess, State of the Union address, decided to put $15 billion into a fight against AIDS? It was like a biblical conversion, for heaven's sakes, $3 billion a year for 5 years. You can't pump that much money into the response to a pandemic without making an appreciable impact, and they have. More people in treatment, some orphan kids addressed, a lot of prevention work. But there have been aspects of the Bush plan which have caused great controversy and, for people like myself, a lot of criticism. There was initially a lot of dependence on the major pharmaceutical industry, and therefore you were paying so much more for the drugs than you would have to if you bought generics. They've never given enough to the Global Fund to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria within the presidential plan. They've always emphasized abstinence over everything else. Well, it's so silly and unscientific. It's so ideologically perverse. that you believe that abstinence is the answer in the AIDS pandemic. I mean, abstinence has its place. It tends to delay the first sexual debut, as they call it, the first sexual act of particularly young girls. But when you're sexually active adolescents, abstinence is no longer valid. And I might point out to those who haven't thought about it in the administration that abstinence in marriage is neither possible nor desirable. There have to be alternatives. And the alternatives which work best are condoms. There's just no question about that. So it is perverse to pursue a policy which emphasizes abstinence to the depreciation of condoms. Abstinence, fidelity, and condoms, the ABCs as they're called, of preventive response, they all have their place. But you can't do without condoms because they are, certainly in the mind of the United Nations, the single most effective preventive intervention.
Stephen Lewis, how did you become persona non grata of the Bush administration? You write about that in the afterword. You can barely appear in the same room with Laura Bush, evidently.
Well, because I had criticized the United States about the abstinence policy, they went apoplectic. I'm too old in the tooth, Matt. I've spent myself way back over 15 years in politics. I know how to roll with the punches. I don't want to pretend to be invulnerable, but I can't take something seriously. And they so grotesquely overreacted. I simply said that the abstinence policy didn't make sense. And they called for my resignation. Senators wrote to the Secretary General. One of the people involved for the United States had a tantrum at a cocktail party. And so I was called by the then Chief of Staff of Kofi Annan, Mark Melick Brown, and said, Stephen, lay off the United States. We want George Bush to come to a conference. And if you attack them again, we're sure he won't come. And I said, Mark, are you crazy? The President of the United States couldn't care less about what Stephen Lewis said. He said, nope. We have to have a guarantee of your silence. I said, okay, I won't criticize for a few months, but as soon as that conference is over, I'm letting loose. And, of course, George Bush didn't come to the conference. He never intended to.
No, that must rankle you, though, when you're told to bite your tongue. You don't seem to be the type who likes to bite his tongue.
No, but, you know, 4 months of biting the tongue for the UN I could cope with. I actually behaved myself, I think, reasonably well over the 5.5 years because there were a lot of things which were really offensive, both within the UN family and its inability to respond with sufficient urgency to the problem, and the behavior of some governments like the United States, like South Africa, like Uganda.
You mentioned Zimbabwe, too.
And Zimbabwe, yeah.
What are the frustrations within the United Nations?
Mostly the slowness, mostly the lack of the sense of emergency, mostly the recognition that the United Nations has tremendous credibility on the ground in these developing countries. People who disparage the United Nations don't understand what a tremendous contribution it has made in health and in nutrition and immunization and labor and all kinds of areas for children and families in the developing world. And the United Nations has an intimate and influential relationship with governments that nobody else has. It can put tremendous pressure on governments and effect social change. And not to use that, to watch with a certain begrudging passivity as the pandemic picked up momentum. I'll never understand that. As a matter of fact, I don't understand it to this day because the United Nations is still not sufficiently engaged.
Stephen Lewis was Canada's ambassador to the United Nations for years. He also was the UN Secretary General's special envoy for HIV AIDS. Your frustrations with the United Nations are not the same frustrations with the United Nations that the neocons and John Bolton had with the United Nations. How do you assess that kind of attack on the United Nations from Washington?
Oh, I think the neocons are nuts, to put it quite simply, and I have absolutely no use for that kind of analysis because it's largely rooted, A, in ideology, and B, in destructive temperament. Neither of them appeals to me. I can feel positions strongly, but I can also respect other people's points of view, but I can't respect points of view that are so rigid in their expression as to leave no room for discussion. and the Bolton view and the Heritage Foundation view and the sort of right wing in combination with the religious right view, I think that's been pretty destructive over the Bush years. All you have to do is look at the policies in Iraq to see how destructive that mindset has been. My criticism of the United Nations flows from a love of the United Nations. I'm crazy about the outfit. I'm a shameless apologist, but it doesn't mean that I can't try to be constructively critical from time to time.
Never solidarity before criticism. Edward Said said that once. Tell me, Stephen Lewis, what your assessment is of Kofi Annan's tenure there.
That's interesting. I think Kofi Annan was a pretty good Secretary General. I like him very much. He's a hugely likable person. I think he suffered the wrath of the United States in a way that was totally unjustified.
The Iraq War seemed to take a toll on
it. The Iraq War took a toll, and some of the Western countries, and particularly the United States, were merciless in their criticism of oil for food when they knew, the permanent members of the Security Council knew exactly what was going on. As a matter of fact, they were fomenting the corruption, and Kofi Annan had to take the rap. I think that was most unfair. On the other hand, I think there is some truth in the question mark about his managerial capacities, and I think had he had a more opportunity and a stronger voice around managing the agencies of the UN, it might have performed better.
Stephen Lewis, the subtitle of your book, Race Against Time, is called Searching for Hope in AIDS-Ravaged Africa. Where do you find that hope?
I find the hope in Africa. I find the hope in the astonishing resilience and courage of those who are dealing with the pandemic at the grassroots and on the ground. It's magnificent to see. And you know that if the Western world delivered on the promises we make, resources, assistance, drugs, whatever, that Africa could break the back of the pandemic. And it's our delinquency rather than their denial, which is frustrating progress.
What would you encourage listeners to this show to do about the AIDS pandemic?
I would, apart from raising personal awareness and consciousness about it, I would attach myself to one of those great NGOs, non-governmental organizations that does such good work on the ground, CARE, Save the Children, Doctors Without Borders, World Vision. World Vision does excellent work. If they want to go through the UN, UNICEF, there are organizations which know what they're doing, where you can raise money, you can participate in policy discussions, you can pick up and spend some time in a developing country yourself making a contribution. If you do, you'll never be the same again. I love American university students. They are really engaged on these issues.
You've founded something called the Stephen Lewis Foundation. What does that do?
We work directly on the ground, putting money right into the grassroots of community-based or faith-based organizations. We don't put it through the big NGOs or governments. It was a dream to give it right to the people who needed it. We work with women who are struggling, are ill, or need palliative care. We do everything there is to do for orphans. We work with groups of people living with AIDS. We deal now with grandmothers. We love working with grandmothers who are looking after orphan grandchildren. The Canadian public has been stunningly generous, Matt, and we've received well over $20 million in something like 3 years, and we're now funding nearly 200 projects in 14 countries.
No kidding. Well, that's impressive. Stephen Lewis has been my guest today on Progressive Radio. He has been the UN Secretary General's Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS in Africa, the author of the prize-winning book Race Against Time, Searching for Hope in AIDS-Ravaged Africa. His foundation, StephenLewisFoundation.org. That's Stephen with a PH. Stephen Lewis, thanks for being my guest today.
A great pleasure.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.